This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Delighted to have Bishop Renee Henry Gracida back on Church and Culture. Bishop Gracida is the Bishop Emeritus of Corpus Christi, Texas. And the last time we had him on, we were talking about his memoir entitled An Ordinary's Not-So-Ordinary Life, which is wonderful, which I strongly recommend to everyone. It's a real eye-opener. Bishop, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dio.
Are you really 95 years old?
As of last Saturday, I am. Yes.
How's that feel? Because I'm heading your direction. How's that feel?
Well, you're a long way from it, I'm sure.
Not that long. Do you feel good?
It feels made different. I'm amazed that at 95, I feel like I'm 85 or 75 or even 65.
Heck, you know, 95 is the new 55.
But there are times when the body lets me know that I'm 95, but as far as the mind is concerned, I'm 65 or 55 even.
I've been reading your blog today, which is www.abyssum.org. That's abyss with two S's with a U-M on the back. Means deep, speaking to deep. Bishop, you know, as I was getting ready to talk to you today, I found out something that we have in common. You were, during World War II, you were in the back of an airplane holding a machine gun. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you, what kind of plane were you in? You were flying out. Were you flying out of England?
Yes. I was a member of a flight crew on a B-17 bomber flying out of Molesworth, England in the 8th Air Force. I flew my first 12 missions as a tail gunner in the tail of the B-17 Flying Fortress. And then after 12 missions, I applied for a change in my rating to flight engineer. Since I had been an engineering student at Rice University in Houston when I was called to active duty. And therefore, I took a test and passed it, and I was promoted to flight engineer. And so for the other 20 missions that I flew in the top turret of the B-17 as a flight engineer. That's a position immediately between the pilot and the co-pilot of the bomber.
Well, I fibbed a little bit when I said we have something in common because it was my father who was the captain of a B-24, first with the Army Air Corps, then with the Air Force flying out of Italy over Eastern Europe. But he survived his 30 missions as well.
Well, I'll tell you a deal. The fact that your father survived is more of a tribute to God's providence than the fact that I survived. Because the B-24 was not as good a plane as the B-17. Matter of fact, it was
lousy plane.
It was known for its fragility. They came apart in the air fairly easily.
Half of his group, I don't know if it's called a squadron or whatever, but half of the men in B-24s never returned from the war.
I believe it. I believe it. It was a terrible attrition rate.
How is it, as a young man from New Orleans, how was it to be firing a machine gun at Germans way up high in the air? Was it frightening?
Well, you are trained, and so I was well trained before I ever went overseas, and therefore I was psychologically and physically and mentally prepared to do my job, which was to defend the bomber by firing my machine guns. And also, as a flight engineer, I was trained and prepared to keep the plane flying in the air by troubleshooting whatever could be trouble shot from the inside the plane.
Did you have any close calls?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. On our fourth mission over Ruhr Valley in Germany, we were subjected to very intense anti-aircraft fire. The anti-aircraft fire came from the famous German gun, the 88-millimeter rifle, and they were very deadly accurate, and the plane was pretty badly shot up. We lost an engine, we were on fire, we were riddled with holes, and we were falling. I had a pilot.
I would say that's a close call, Bishop.
It was. The pilot gave the order, prepare to bail out. Now look, I am afraid of heights.
Oh no!
So when I knelt in the open door of the tail with my parachute on, ready to pitch forward into open space, 25,000 feet above the earth, waiting for the pilot order to bail out, I was not exactly happy, I'll tell you.
Did you have to jump?
No. At the last minute, the pilot regained control of the plane, and he extinguished the fire of the engine that was on fire, and we descended to ground level, and we flew back to England at treetop level.
And how much of the plane was left when you landed?
Well, it was intact, but it was riddled with holes.
Wow. Well, I'm sure there were other close calls like that, and I really admire you so much. This is the kind of experience our young people need to hear about from people like you who were there, who put their lives on the line for freedom and for the freedom of other people, you know, around the world. Over the years, how often do you think of those days?
Well, not very often that I actually think about combat, but I think about the war itself quite frequently because of the many parallels which recur in history. Right now, the dangerous relationship we're having with North Korea, the dangerous relationship we're having with Russia, the dangerous relationship we're having with Iran. All of these international problems are reminiscent for me of Munich, Hitler, Chamberlain. And I lived as a teenager through those years, and they're fresh in my memory. I still think every now and then about Neville Chamberlain stepping off the plane in England and telling the English people, we have just avoided the World War. And then,
yeah, you were around 11 or 12 then, right?
That's correct. Then a couple of months later, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. So I've been there, done that. It's like that commercial for Farmers Insurance. We know a few things and we've seen a few things.
Yeah, you sure have. You know, I know our listeners would love to hear more about this, and maybe we can schedule another show because these kind of stories are so important, but I'm curious. You went to Rice. You got your degree in architecture, correct?
Well, I did. See, I was interrupted at the end of my first year. I came back from the war and finished my architectural studies at the University of Houston because they had a new school of architecture doing contemporary studies, whereas Rice, that year I spent at Rice was a year spent studying Greek and Roman temples. I'd had my fill of that.
What did you do at the University of Fribourg?
After I graduated with a degree in architecture, my vocation to the priesthood began to assert itself. Since my education was so heavy in engineering subjects, I was very much lacking in the humanities, and especially history, theology, philosophy, psychology, those subjects. So I went to Fribourg for a year and studied there, taking nothing but humanities.
And you did all this in German?
French. Fribourg is in the canton of Switzerland that speaks French. Fribourg is in Germany. Fribourg
is in
Switzerland.
I got you. And where'd your French come from? New Orleans?
Yeah, my mother's family is totally French. And the first language in our home in New Orleans was English, of course. But the second language, spoken almost as frequently as English, was French. My father was born in Oaxaca in Mexico, but he had a falling out with his family, and so he never referred to his family, and he did not speak Spanish at all ever. And the only thing that my father ever did or said that betrayed his birthplace was occasionally once or twice a year he'd say, "I've got to have a tamale."
And that, of course, elicited a good laugh all around.
Of course, of course.
So you then, I guess, was your transition period through a Benedictine monastery?
Yes, after I graduated with my degree in architectural engineering, to be exact, my vocation manifested itself very dramatically. I really felt that I was not called to spend the rest of my life working with glass and steel and wood and brick and concrete. So I made a retreat and up at the Benedictine Monastery in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And then I went to Fribourg, and on my way to Fribourg, I stopped off at St. Vincent Arch Abbey in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, fell in love with the place and the monks. So when I came back from Fribourg, I made my decision to enter St. Vincent Arch Abbey as a Benedictine monk.
And you got your master's in divinity there, and you went on to get a doctor of laws at St.
Well,
Leo.
Well, that's honoris causa from St. Leo University in Florida. They awarded me the doctor of laws degree. Honoris causa, because
well, I'm
of
sure
my full life.
I'm sure you knew
my
enough. Anyway,
because of my full life work.
Yeah, I know. You knew enough, you know, to earn it, so to speak.
I'd like to think that I earned it.
You did. So when you were ordained a priest in 1959, you were 36 years old. And who ordained you?
Benedictines are not allowed to ordain their priests. They must ask the local bishop or some bishop to do that. And so the Archabbot of St. Vincent issued what is called a dimissorial letter to the Bishop Hugh Lamb of Greensburg, and he ordained my class of 12 monks.
And then your first appointment was by Pope Paul VI to be auxiliary of Miami, is that correct?
Well, no. It's a long story. In my book, I tell the sad story of the fact that the Archabbot of St. Vincent wanted to build some dormitories for the college, and my opinion of those dormitory plans caused the community to reject his building project. And
uh-oh.
So he invited me to leave the monastery. He had no canonical reason to do
that. Well, you were an architect.
That's why he invited me to leave. He did not want an architect in his community because he had building plans.
Right.
So anyway, I really wrestled with it for a year, and finally I said, "Look, he's my archabbot. He takes the place of Christ. He's asked me to leave the order. I'm going to obey, and I will leave the order. But even though I may get dispensed formally from my vows, I will never stop thinking that I have them. And so I've lived all my life with the vows that I had, except the vow, of course, of stability. I've moved around an awful lot since I left the monastery, so it's good that I didn't try to keep that vow.
So how did you then enter the episcopate?
Well, interesting. To leave the monastery, I had to have a bishop willing to accept me into his presbyterate. The only bishop that I knew was Coleman Francis Carroll. And the only reason I knew him was because he was from Pittsburgh, and he had made his ordination consecration retreat at St. Vincent, and I was the guest master. So I took care of him. So naturally, we became friends. So when I had to find a bishop to accept me into his diocese, I wrote to him. It's the only bishop I knew. And he wrote back immediately and said, yes, come, by all means. So I went to Miami, where he was then bishop. Now, little did I know that he had planned for me, which, of course, I never would have guessed. And so I spent the next 10 years going through various trials that he put me through as he was testing me. For example, he transferred me to 13 different parishes in 10 years.
Lord. What, were you considered Mr. Fix-It or something?
Yes, he was using, because I was older, he was using me to solve some of his problems, but boy, he was creating them for me.
Right.
So eventually, after 10 years of serving him well and never questioning, I never once objected to those transfers. That's how I was keeping my vow of obedience. Every time he would transfer me, and sometimes I get a transfer by a letter in the mail. Sometimes I get a transfer by someone telling me, oh, sorry to hear that you're being transferred. Wow.
Like it, somebody at lunch kind of leans over and says, oh, by the way, you've been transferred.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So after 10 years of being totally obedient to him, he asked Pope Paul VI to make me his auxiliary bishop. Now, I had, when I left the monastery, I had what is called a dirum impediment. It absolutely prohibited me from ever being a Monsignor, much less a bishop. So he had to go to Paul VI and personally plead with him to either dispense from that canon law or to abrogate the canon law. Well, it ended up Paul abrogated the canon law. He asked the congregation for bishops and the congregation for religious. If the canon, which originated in the Middle Ages, was obsolete, they said yes. So he deleted it from the Code of Canon Law and then appointed me auxiliary bishop of Miami.
Well, you were causing trouble from the very beginning.
Always, always, always. It's my nature of my personality, I guess. I'm always causing trouble.
No wonder they made you a tail gunner.
Exactly.
Well, you...
Before I walked out of the plane.
Where did you go from Miami?
Well, from Miami, Paul VI appointed me the first bishop of the new diocese of Pensacola-Tallahassee in 1975. And so I went to Pensacola-Tallahassee, started the new diocese, organized it, and then 8 years later, John Paul II transferred me to Corpus Christi.
And you went to Corpus Christi in 1983, is that correct?
1983.
And you served how many years there?
Well, I served from 83 to 97.
And is Corpus Christi really where you feel your home is at this point in your life?
Yes, very much so. First of all, I had the great privilege and honor of being invited by Cardinal Wojtyla to come visit him in Krakow before he was Pope. I visited him.
By the way, Bishop, I'll interrupt you and just say, how did that invitation come about?
All right, at the time I was a member of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, and I was chairman of the committee, of all things, of migration and refugee service.
Oh, here we go. We're off and running.
For 14 years, I was chairman of that committee because it was not a standing committee. Now it's a standing committee, so the bishop is the chairman, is elected every 3 years. So believe me, I know something about migration.
Well, that's what we're talking about after the break, but for right now, let's keep going.
I'm ready, willing, and able to talk
okay.
more about it.
Okay.
So
you, what was that meeting with Wojtyla like?
All right. As chairman of the committee, I was aware of the problem that there were a large number of Polish priests who had been sent from Poland to care for Polish immigrants in foreign countries like Brazil and Australia and the United States for contract for 5 years. And when their contract was up, those men were not able to return to communist Poland. So they came to the United States. And they were irregular. They didn't understand our system of governance of the church. Poland doesn't have chanceries like we do. So they were getting into trouble. So I proposed to the bishops of the United States that we have a short course at the Catholic University of America where they would be taught something about what it is to be a priest in an American diocese. The bishops of the United States voted unanimously in favor of the program. Present at the meeting was, of course, the nuncio to the United States. He sent a report back to Rome, and in Rome, they sent a copy of what I proposed to the Polish cardinal who's in charge of migration for Poland, who happened to be Cardinal Wojtyla. So next thing I know, I get a letter from signed by jointly by Cardinal Wojtyla and Cardinal Wyszynski inviting me to come to Poland to visit with both of them and to tell them about my program for training Polish priests to work effectively in American parishes and dioceses. And so that's what I did. I arrived in Warsaw. Get this. I arrived in Warsaw at the Cardinal's residence on the morning that John Paul I died.
Seriously? You're making this up.
No, I'm serious. So when I entered the house, a nun let me into the house of the Cardinal. I was waiting in the parlor, and soon the Cardinal entered, and I took his hand, and I said to him, "Your Eminence, I'm very sad and shocked over the news that I just heard at the shrine of Częstochowa that our Holy Father John Paul the First died last night." And he said to me, "Yes, Bishop Rene, I also am deeply shocked and troubled by that." And little did I realize that I was shaking and holding the hand of the man who in 3 weeks' time would be John Paul II.
Do you think he had any inkling?
No. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I stayed with him for 3 days, and in all of our conversations, he never said anything that gave me the slightest inkling that he anticipated being elected Pope.
What did you feel about him after the, you know, during those 3 days? What were your impressions of him?
Well, I fell in love with the man. He was very hospitable, very friendly, and naturally, you know, it's a matter of self-pride, I guess, that he was more interested in me than I ever would have anticipated. He wanted to know all about my experience in the war, what was it like flying in bombers, which cities did I bomb. At every meal, we talked about the Second World War more than we talked about other things that we should have been talking about.
Well, given what happened to Poland, I can understand his deep interest.
Oh, yes. He suffered terribly.
You know, I might just say that when I've been in presence of men I consider truly great, Bishop, I'm also startled by the interest they show in me personally. I'm always startled by that. It's only happened to me a couple of times, but it all seems to happen every time.
That's exactly what happened to me in Krakow.
Well, you know, that's What a moment. And I assume when he was elected, you were thrilled.
I was. Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I flew to Rome ahead of him because I had a meeting of the Pontifical Commission for Migration and Refugees that I had to attend. Of course, it was canceled because of the death of the Pope. But he flew a day or two after me to Rome, and then I got a call at the Casa Internazionale del Ferro where I was staying. And the call said, I'm calling from the Polish seminary. Cardinal Wojtyla is here, and he wants you to come to lunch today. Can you come? We'll send a car for you. Well, naturally, I was flattered and thrilled. So they sent a car, and I went to the Polish seminary, and I had lunch with him, and we ate in the refectory of the seminary, and he introduced me to all of the seminarians as the Texas bishop who flew in a B-17 bomber.
Oh, that's so fun.
the seminarians were—they all applauded and cheered. You know, it was a great experience. So we talked for another hour or two. Then I went back, and then my meeting was canceled, and I returned to Tallahassee. And here's the funny story.
Wait, hold on.
Hey,
Bishop.
Okay, go ahead.
We're going to take a very quick break because I don't want anything to rush the story you're about to tell. We're
okay.
Going to be back with Bishop Renee Henry Reseda, the Bishop Emeritus of Corpus Christi, lucid and alive at 95 as much as I am at 68. We'll be right back.
Are you tired of how your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. So the same reason you listen to Ave Maria Radio, get the Michigan Catholic for only $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.org.
The Chaldean News is a monthly news magazine about the Chaldean community and for the Chaldean community and for anyone wanting to learn about the Chaldeans or work with them. Chaldeans are Christians from Iraq. They are the indigenous people of the region. They speak Aramaic, the language of Jesus, and were converted to Christianity by St. Thomas the Apostle, who is a patron saint for the Chaldeans. The Chaldean News covers all of the community news in the United States and around the globe, from local business developments to what's going on in Iraq. The Chaldean News also publishes up-to-date stories on social media, including on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. New stories are posted regularly on the website at ChaldeanNews.com. You can subscribe today and keep abreast of what's going on in the Chaldean community. Find out more by going to thechaldeannews.com or find us on social media platforms.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, God himself took on flesh and submitted himself to his own laws. What other response can we have except that of Elder Simeon? Now you may dismiss your servant, O Lord.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Reseda, Bishop Emeritus of Corpus Christi, and just before the break, Bishop, you were about to tell a story about something that happened when you came back from having lunch with Cardinal Wojtyla in Rome. What happened?
Well, I had a meeting of the deanery, the Tallahassee Deanery in Florida, and so I had about 12 priests outside on my terrace, having lunch, and I had the radio turned on to see if we would hear any news of the conclave that was underway. And during the lunch, a Polish-American priest who was sitting at my table, Father Ed Zinkiewicz. And Father Ed told a Polish joke. Well, in mock seriousness, I wrapped my ring on the table, and I said, Father Ed, no more. Let's have no more Polish jokes. As far as we know, the next pope may be Polish. And at that very moment, my vicar general came out onto the terrace, and he heard me say that. And he said, but Bishop, the new pope is Polish. And I thought he was going along with Zinkiewicz's joke. So I said, come on, Monsignor, let's have none of that. You're just encouraging Father Ed to tell more Polish jokes. So he said, no, seriously, I heard it in the car. I was driving here to your house. I said, what's his name? He said, I can't pronounce it.
Oh, no.
I said, does it sound like Wojtyła? He said, that's it. I said, good grief. I was floored. I really was. I had not expected it. I didn't know that it would happen. You know, in those days, you thought of Italian. You thought, well, you know, the next pope was going to be an Italian. The one that just died was Italian, and the one before him was Italian, and the one before him was Italian. So you expected the next pope to be Italian. So when I learned that Wojtyła had been elected pope, I was dumbfounded.
Well, everybody must have kidded you about how you had automatic entree into the papal apartments.
They did. They said, well, golly, you're in like Flynn now, Bishop. You've got it made. Well, I must tell you, I studiously avoided letting the Pope, John Paul II, think for one minute that I was trying to parlay my friendship with him to my advantage. I was perfectly happy being Bishop of, at the time, Pensacola, Tallahassee. Then later, when he transferred me to Corpus Christi, I said, well, that's wonderful, but that's enough, no more. I have no aspirations to be an archbishop. On the contrary, I doubted that my having been dispensed from solemn vows would ever allow Rome to make me an archbishop, and I'm pretty sure that was true. It wasn't, even though the impediment had been dispensed and the canon changed, Rome's antipathies to people leaving monasteries was so great that I knew that I could never be an archbishop.
You didn't want to cause any more trouble.
I could have caused a lot of trouble as an archbishop, and it's a good thing I didn't go up.
You know, the last time you were on the show, we talked a lot about, you know, what I would call the abortion wars that you went through. I don't want to go back to that right now. I want to go with this issue of immigration, because here you were for, did you say 12 years?
14.
14 years, the head of the International Commission, the Catholic Commission on Immigration and Migration. Is that the correct name of it?
No, it was the National Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration and Tourism.
Okay.
Refugees.
There's another international commission that I'm thinking
that's
of.
That's called the ICMIC. That's called the International Commission on Migration. Yes.
Okay. So for 14 years, you had this bishops' commission, and then you were bishop and then a bishop emeritus of Corpus Christi, which is right there at the southern border. I sent you an article today I wrote about the recent comment by a bishop from Arizona suggesting that those persons who are implementing immigration law under President Trump should be considered for canonical penalties, including excommunication. And I, of course, in my column, I argued basically that didn't make any sense to me. What do you think of that?
I think it's scandalous that a bishop would say that, propose that. First of all, these men who are serving in Border Patrol and ICE, they're doing their job. They're doing their duty as civil servants. They are not, they didn't write the law. They're enforcing the law. And for a bishop to propose that a civil servant should be penalized or punished for doing his job is unconscionable. It doesn't make sense to me that a bishop would propose that civil servants should be held morally responsible for the laws that Congress passes. It doesn't make sense.
But yeah, and of course he suggested that there were other border bishops, as he put it, that were in agreement. But what shocked me the most is that no one stood either then or since to challenge it. Until now, of course, when you are.
Well, I certainly challenge it.
Yeah, I know you are. But why? Since it really defies common, what I would call Catholic common sense, why would nobody just stand up and say, no, that's going too far?
Well, give him time. You know, he just said it a couple days ago, I believe. And
it probably
hasn't been disseminated yet all over the country.
Oh, it's out there, Bishop.
Well, it is now.
It's front page, New York Times, Washington Post.
All right, right. But what I'm saying is that because it is now front page, people will react to it as I'm reacting to it, saying that it is absurd that a bishop should propose canonical penalties for citizens employed by the government to administer law, that they should be subjected to the church's canonical penalties. It's idiotic. It really is.
Well, you did some of that kind of quote-unquote pastoral care when you were actively the Bishop of Corpus Christi in regard to abortionists and politicians who are pro-abortion. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
And that didn't go over too well with your fellow bishops, did it?
No. The reason is because it put them on the spot. You know, I don't think there's a major city in the United States that doesn't have abortion clinics. And many of those abortion clinics are probably staffed or run by Roman Catholics. So the need for bishops to be vigilant and to impose the penalties of canon law upon Roman Catholics who participate directly in the procuring of abortions is obvious. But I think most bishops, as far as I know, I'm the only bishop in the United States who ever excommunicated an abortionist, a Catholic abortionist. And I think most bishops were terrified at the prospect that they might be called upon to take some canonical action against an abortionist. The resulting publicity is not enjoyable. I mean, I was pilloried by the secular press here in Texas when I excommunicated those three abortionists. I was pilloried and criticized, condemned, and I was accused of mixing church and state, of all things, and interfering in state matters, mixing religion and politics, all of that. So it's dangerous. I think most bishops run scared when they get into a situation where they might suddenly get a lot of bad publicity. They don't want that. So, I'll give you an example. This is a terrible example, and I hate to say it. But you've brought the subject up, so I have to say it. I was a member of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Pro-Life Activities. The chairman was Cardinal O'Connor. There were seven bishops who were members of the committee. We had a meeting shortly after I excommunicated the three Catholics who were abortionists. And at the end of the meeting, I said to the Cardinal, I would like to offer some explanation of what recently happened in Corpus Christi, namely the excommunication of the three Catholic abortionists. And he said, go right ahead, Bishop. So I did. I spoke for about 15 or 20 minutes and explained all about the process, about the need, about the scandal, attending to the fact that the paper was playing up the fact that these abortionists were Catholic. So I finished talking to the seven bishops on the committee. I said, now I'm very willing and eager to answer any questions you may have. Neil, I'm not exaggerating. I sat there for about 4 or 5 minutes in total silence. None of the bishops had a single question for me or a comment. And after about 5 minutes of silence, very painful silence, Colonel O'Connor said, well, if there's no further business, meeting adjourned.
Do you feel like Cardinal O'Connor let you down there?
Absolutely he did. Sure he did. Hey, look, he had in New York City, don't you believe they're abortionists?
Oh, yeah.
So what I said, you know, put him on the spot. Why isn't he excommunicating Catholic abortionists in New York City? See? All seven of them were squirming in the chairs as I spoke. Because they were imagining, you know, is he going to ask us, is Bishop Casita going to ask us, what are you doing in your diocese?
Well, you know, Bishop Gracida, this is, of course, the obvious point I made in my column that was published today, and that is, you know, why all this, you know, high dudgeon, and it's an old phrase, but, you know, why all this moralistic righteousness about Border Patrol officers and ICE officers when you are the only bishop who ever excommunicated any abortionist, and there have been a few sprinkling of either threats of excommunication or actual excommunication since then, I think Cardinal Burke in particular, but nothing like the kind of mass action that the present situation and the situation over the last 40 years would demand.
You're right. Situation has gotten terrible, far worse over the last 40 years.
I mean, what was the turning point? You know, I remember when, for example, you know, we all know the stories about Ted Kennedy. He was talked out of being pro-life by four Jesuit theologians visiting his summer home. And, you know, we all know about the career of Father Drinan when he was in Congress and he was supporting partial birth abortion. But what do you think was the real turning point when things, you know, got so far out there that bishops just, like you say, were scared to touch it?
Yes, it was and is a toxic subject. They're willing to talk about immigration. They're willing to talk about global warming, but they're afraid to talk about the taking of the unborn human life.
And are you surprised that there's been no public commendation toward the president for being the most pro-life president in American history?
Yes, of course. But, you know, most bishops, I think, are Democrats. They come from family roots in our country that were Democratic. Their mother, their father, their grandfather, they were, you know, let's say Irish immigrants working on the railroad. They were Democrats. So most bishops come from Democratic roots.
What about just basic fairness? I mean, even if you're Democrat and you're Catholic, you look at a president who's done all this.
I'm talking about cultural conditioning.
Yeah, I mean,
not intellectual thought, you know.
Right.
they grew up in homes where Roosevelt was praised and Democrats were praised and Republicans were considered to be hostile to the working man. So,
yeah, of course, the Republicans are ones that freed the slaves.
Well, of course. I mean, that's the greatest hypocrisy in our country is the way that the Democrats on the left identify with the black people and call all Republicans and everyone else racist. That has to be the greatest hypocrisy, because up until modern times, it was the Democratic senators who kept the slaves.
Yeah, Lyndon Johnson had to beat them down with a stick to get his legislation passed.
Exactly.
Now, let me ask you this, Bishop. We do have a serious situation at the border. Could you offer just some sort of guidance to how thoughtful people of goodwill could begin to try to come to some sort of agreement on, you know, just what to do? You know, try to get past the rancor and the accusations. You know, just what's a simple set of starting points for this?
Well, politically, I'll start politically. Politically, what everyone has to recognize is that the current administration, which includes especially, primarily, the men on the border, Border Patrolmen and ICE, these men are charged or sworn to enforce the law. And the law that they're sworn to enforce is the law passed under President Obama during his administration on how to handle people crossing the border illegally. That's the first thing you have to keep in mind. Everyone is accusing Trump and the Republicans for snatching babies out of mothers' arms. But in point of reality, the law that is being enforced by Border Patrol and ICE originated in the Obama administration, not the Trump administration. Secondly, I think that from what I've read and from what I know from my own experience, because I visited the border as chairman of the Migration Committee, I met with Border Patrol people, I met with administration judges, I met with bishops of Mexico, I met with officials on the other side of the border, trying always to find some way to help people know the dangers of setting out to cross the border illegally. For 14 years, I worked with the administration of Mexico and the administration of the United States trying to solve the problem of illegal immigration and the suffering that immigrants experience crossing the desert, accompanied or guided by coyotes, or men that are profiting from their desire to enter the United States illegally. Now, accepting the reality that this is nothing new, the problem has existed for a long time, and the law presently in force, which is being enforced, is a law administered by Democrats, passed by Democrats, passed, signed by Obama. That's the law that they're struggling to work with now. Trump, President Trump, and the Republicans have not passed any immigration laws since he took office. Therefore, everything that is being done under laws passed by Democrats. Secondly, it is extremely difficult to generalize and to talk about the welfare of young people when you have a situation that is so extremely complex. As for example, one of the biggest problems facing the world, and the United States is not exempt from it, is human trafficking, especially from the Orient, especially from South America and Central America. Criminals abduct young people, and by holding their parents captive, bring them into the United States, posing as their parents, and introduce them into the sex trade. They enter brothels, or they're assigned to some pimp who then works them and collects the money from the sexual activities that they sell. This goes on, and to say that every child coming across the border in the company of an adult is truly the child of the adult who has the child and accompanies the child is to ignore the fact that the human trafficking is very much alive and is very large. It's going on all over the world, and it's happening here in the United States. So when the cartel seeks to make money not only from drugs, but from selling human beings for the sex trade, I think we ought to be very careful about suddenly insisting that we leave these young people in the care of the adults that brought them across the border. Because the adults that bring them across the border may not be their real parents. They may be entrusting them to cartel members. Those are some thoughts off the top of my head about...
Well, I mean, you know, Bishop, that's a very good start because what you're saying is there's very good reason to hold these folks for a while, find out who they are, find out if the children or young people they're bringing over really are their parents. There is a reason not to just have a complete open door, get in a bus and we'll take you someplace to live and someplace to set up a new life. There needs to be a filtering system of some kind. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And that's exactly what the system is set up to do.
Do the Catholic bishops not recognize that need?
Well, look, I hate to say it, but bishops are very sensitive to the fact that a large number of their parishioners are Hispanic, and therefore they think that they are winning the favor of the Catholics, Hispanic Catholics, by calling for open borders and letting everyone come in, not being in any way cautious in enforcing the law. So bishops, I think, are pandering to especially, I'm concerned about the people in El Paso, the bishop of El Paso, and the politicians from El Paso. They're outrageous in wanting almost completely open borders and people coming through whenever they want to. It really is not what the church teaches about the right to emigrate and immigrate. The church says that nations have a right to control immigration, and while people have a right to emigrate, leave their country, they aren't free to go to just any country but the truth. So the church is very clear in its teaching, but sad to say, I don't hear very many bishops quoting what the church has to say about in the Catechism of the Catholic Church about immigration.
Now, if you read it, which you have obviously, and I have, it says that the right to leave a country is offset by a right of a country to deny them entrance.
Exactly.
And now you have bishops saying that any law, civil law, passed barring entrance is against natural law.
Exactly. It's absurd. It is absurd.
I mean, and then, by then, they're trying to equate it with abortion.
Exactly. And speaking, now that you mentioned the word, there's nothing worse than the separation of a child from the parents than what occurs in abortion.
There's the real separation. You know, Bishop, we've come to the end of our time. I want to remind our listeners that we've been talking to Bishop Rene Henry Gracida, 95 years old, Bishop Emeritus, Corpus Christi. Bishop, will you come back very soon to be on the show again? We have much more to talk about.
I'd love to if they'll let me.
Well, I'll let you. And to all of you listening, we'll look forward to talking to the bishop again soon. In the meantime, I have another great guest coming on right after this brief message.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
We're going to continue sharing material from our time at Acton University. Father Ben Johnson looking at the poisonous ideology of the alt-right. Dr. John Pinheiro on religious liberty dawning in the United States. And Father Gregory Jensen discussing how East meets West and consumerism versus asceticism.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.